Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. There are now 10,775 COVID-19 cases in the United States, according to Johns Hopkins University. But without widespread testing, we just don't know the real numbers. So today we're going to talk about testing, where you can actually get a test, and why the United States was so unprepared for testing in the first place. Joining us right now is Catherine Ho. Kat covers healthcare and medical technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. Before joining the paper in 2017, she worked for the Washington Post and the LA Times. And this week, Kat reported on where people in the Bay Area can get tested for COVID-19. Hi, Kat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, sure thing.
Great to have you. Well, Kat, we air in the Bay Area, but we also air in other states across the country. So I just want to ask you a more general question. Based on the reporting that you have done, why has it taken so long for widespread testing to roll out in the United States? We're going to go into that more in depth later in the show, but I just wanted to get your quick thoughts on that based on your reporting.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's something that we're all still trying to get to the bottom of. So initially, the U.S. wanted to make its own tests. There were WHO tests that appeared to be available, you know, early on in this pandemic. The CDC wanted to make its own test, but as it was rolling those out, there was an issue with one of the test components, which made a lot of the tests unusable. And so they tried to fix that problem, which took some time. So it's only really been the last maybe 2-3 weeks that more tests are becoming available to public health labs. You know, some universities actually ended up developing their own tests that came out, but, you know, that they finished working on those before those institutions were able to get the CDC tests.
We're also learning that there are various elements to this test. So, you know, for those of us who've had a blood test, for example, you simply give your blood, there are a number of vials, and it's done. But with the COVID-19 test, there are various elements to it, and that's also part of the problem, right?
That's right. So right now what we're hearing is the shortage is in the swab. So that's, you know, the thing that it's not exactly like a Q-tip, but, you know, the doctor or the nurse will stick it way up your nose or down your throat in order to take the sample. And we're hearing from quite a number of physicians in the area that they either have not received the number of swabs they were expecting or that they are running pretty low on them.
And at this point, what are you hearing about how testing will ramp up? What is taking place at the state and federal level?
Yeah, so we're expecting testing to ramp up definitely by the end of this week, at least if the big commercial labs, I guess, are to be believed. Those are, you know, like LabCorp and Quest, who are the big companies that do the lab processing of these tests. And by the end of this week, they're supposed to have testing capacity up by into the, you know, tens of thousands per day. What we're hearing from people, though, is they're still having a lot of trouble getting tested. It's taking, you know, a number of days for them to communicate with their doctor, for their doctor to then assess their symptoms, because you really have to be quite sick right now to get a test, or hospitalized, or in a high-risk group. Not everyone can just go get tested, but it's taking a lot of time for, you know, doctors to assess you and then make the order for the test and then get the test from the lab companies and then get you over, you know, to wherever you need to go to make an appointment to get swabbed. So we're hearing a lot of frustration from people that it's just taking a lot of time to get tested.
And Kat, I've been thinking a lot about people who don't have health insurance. Even for those of us who either have health insurance or if we are underinsured, if we have a doctor, I mean, I know from personal experience, you know, sometimes it takes a while to even get your phone call answered or to get a phone call back. I've been taking care of someone for the last year and a half, so I have a lot of experience with the medical field, and it's just hard to get a phone call back. What about people who do not have health insurance at all? What options are out there for them if they have symptoms?
That's a great question. I would say maybe try an urgent care clinic right now if you don't have a regular doctor, and they might be able to direct you to someone. You know, there is talk right now in some of the federal agencies in the states about how they might be able to make access better for people, for example, here in California on Medi-Cal. Uh-huh. And I think some of those details are still being worked on. But you're right in that I think this pandemic really highlights a lot of weaknesses in our healthcare system with people, especially low-income people, not having access to care.
Exactly. And we're going to do a whole show on that to let people know what they can do if they do not have health insurance. The other question I had for you is the cost of the test. A California representative, Katie Porter, was very relentless a couple of weeks ago when she was questioning Robert Redfield, director of Centers for Disease Control. And she tallied up the cost, saying that it would be about $1,300 out of pocket for a test. She questioned him and questioned him until he finally said, all of the testing will be free. So do you know, Kat, at this point, anyone who needs a test, will the costs be waived?
I don't know if it's anyone. We have seen a lot of the large commercial health insurance companies come out and say, we will cover the cost of the test. We should make this distinction. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to cover the cost of treatment, for example, if you're hospitalized. But we have heard from some large health insurers who've come out and said they will pay for just the test.
Okay. Now, give us a sense of what happens when a state does have access to a lot of tests, because New York Governor Andrew Cuomo gave a press conference this morning, and he said we did 8,000 tests overnight. And he said, in this situation, the more you test, the more positives you're going to find. He said, we haven't gotten this morning's tally, but you're going to see it jump astronomically, I have no doubt, because we did so many. So can you talk about this? Just what's going to happen once we do have widespread access to testing?
I think it almost certainly the numbers of positive cases will go up. We're not exactly sure how much they will go up, but we do know the virus has now been spreading in the community for longer than we initially thought, and likely before we detected, you know, the first community spread cases. So I do believe that as testing becomes more available and results are coming in faster, the numbers will go up.
All right. Today we are speaking with Catherine Ho. She covers healthcare and medical technology for the San Francisco Chronicle, and she has been writing about testing. And if you have any questions or comments specifically about testing, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Kat, I'm not sure you can answer this, but this is on our website. A question from a listener writes, I don't think I've ever heard anyone talking about the rates of false positives and false negatives of this test. That might account for stories about people who've contracted the coronavirus, gone through it, gotten over it, and then test positive for it. There's a lot that the scientific and medical community seem to not be talking about. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, we actually we published a story last week about some patients getting inconsistent test results. You know, they were taking a test every couple days, and they were getting a positive one day and a negative the next, and then a negative after that, and then a positive after that over a pretty short span of time. And when we spoke to some of the experts about this, there were a couple things that I think are happening. One is, you know, your body holds on to the virus differently. You know, you can test positive before you show symptoms if you're kind of in early stages of progression. And I guess the issue with this virus is that I think we're still figuring out what exactly, when exactly is the best time to test for it, like where in the lifespan of the virus is the ideal time to test for it. It can show up more strongly in one part of your body, for example, your throat versus your nose at different times. So that I think that does make it difficult to get a consistent reading. I think what most what the advice is now is you have to test negative twice in a row in order to be, I guess, considered clear of it. That's kind of what we're going by right now.
And how long does this take? Because you've all reported that at Stanford it can take 24 hours, while at Kaiser it can take 4 to 7 days. According to the CDC, it can take 2 to 14 days. And right now we're talking about how long it takes for symptoms to show up.
For symptoms, I think it's anywhere between a few days to probably a week and a half from the time you contract it to when you show symptoms. Some people never show symptoms, but I believe the average amount of time it takes to develop symptoms is something between 5 and 12 days.
Okay, and sorry, I was just confused here. I was reading about symptoms and then test results going back in the same sentence. So it looks like, according to the CDC, it can take 2 to 14 days for symptoms to show up. But like you said, we might have it and never know it. In terms of getting the results back, how long does that take?
Yeah, so it varies greatly depending on where you get tested. So the reason why Stanford gets results so fast is because they develop their own test and they're using their own in-house lab. That's why you get results so quickly. Most of the other providers right now are using LabCorp or Quest, and so they have to send those off, you know, to get processed. So that usually takes a couple of days to, you know, maybe 2 to 5 days, something like that.
We have a question from Craig in San Francisco. He says his niece is 28 and symptomatic. His niece has a dry cough and other symptoms, but Kaiser recommended not to come in and get tested. So does she have to get a doctor's recommendation to get tested?
Most places right now, not all, but most are requiring a doctor's order, and Kaiser is one of them. So right now, because there just aren't enough tests, every healthcare system is prioritizing the highest risk people first. So that's people who are already very, very ill with respiratory symptoms who are hospitalized. Or if you have, you know, if you're older, 50 or above, you have chronic health conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, because those are risk factors for becoming very sick if you do get it. So that doesn't mean that, you know, young, healthy people cannot be, you know, developing very serious symptoms. It just means that right now the healthcare system isn't equipped yet to test everybody who probably should get tested. So they're having to prioritize the sickest people first.
And Kat, what are you hearing from hospitals about how they are ramping up for all of the phone calls that are coming in? Because, you know, for the past 15 days or so, I mean, we talked to a nurse who talked about how hospitals are woefully unprepared for this outbreak. And on Twitter this morning, a number of healthcare providers were tweeting about the lack of masks, the lack of ventilators. They want to get their stories out there. What have you been hearing from hospitals about just all the phone calls that they're getting and how they're dealing with all of that?
Yeah, so I think the concern about protective masks is a real one. We've heard hospitals are running quite low on masks, gloves, gowns, face shields, you know, there's all the protective gears that nurses, doctors, NPs, everyone, you know, is wearing when coming into contact with patients who they think have coronavirus. Hospitals are doing, I think, everything they can right now to try to up their supply. The problem is this is a worldwide issue right now, and everyone's kind of trying to get at the same finite you know, number of masks that exist right now. So there's, you know, some efforts being done to try to ramp up manufacturing, but there's still a very serious, you know, most hospitals are not out right now, you know, of masks. We should be clear, but they are in some cases advising their staff to reuse masks or to only use, you know, an N95 respirator, for example, if you're treating a known patient, but otherwise use, you know, like a regular surgical mask. So they're really trying to, you know, kind of reserve what they have left.
Kat, in one of your recent pieces, you report that there is a lot of confusion among residents. A lot of Bay Area residents reached out to you and expressed frustration about delays, red tape, and conflicting information on whether, where, and how they can get tested. Can you tell us some of those stories?
Yeah, some patients went to a clinic where they thought they would be able to get tested and were told, for example, to call a number that was a coronavirus number. When they called that, it was, you know, closed for the day. So they tried back the next morning and they were told to go, you know, back to that clinic. I spoke to another patient whose doctor did order them a test, and that patient was told to go to one of the, you know, lab locations. The lab told them, no, we don't actually take your sample here. We just process the test, sent that person back to their doctor. Their doctor wasn't sure where, you know, the test should be done, where to send the patient exactly, and that person did eventually figure out which urgent care centers, you know, within that hospital system were doing the testing. But, you know, I think there's just a lot of general, or at least there was earlier this week, where you should be going for testing, even within health systems internally. I think because all this is just coming online right now, people are still figuring out what exactly the protocol is and what to tell people and where to send them. You know, I think it's smoothing out a little bit right now that some time has passed. But it was definitely a point of confusion.
Right. And I'm wondering, the state of California just put up a new website with information about symptoms and risks, getting tested and treatment, applying for unemployment, applying for disability, family paid leave, small business. And that website is covid19.ca.gov. Kat, do you know if governments are planning to maybe put a hotline together so people can just call one number to get all of the information that they need, especially when it comes to testing?
That's a good question. I don't know if there is a statewide hotline for that information. People might want to check with their county health department first, because a lot of this is being managed at the county level. And I would go there first.
Okay. Well, today we are speaking with Catherine Ho, and Catherine is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle, where she covers healthcare and medical technology. And thanks to the Chronicle, they lifted their paywall on all stories about COVID-19. And I'm just getting some breaking news on my phone. Again, we have tragic news coming out of Italy. According to the Washington Post, Italy's coronavirus death toll reaches 3,405. Wow, this is just so tragic, becoming the highest in the world. They're surpassing China's reported total. Just in one day, another 427 people have died. Oh, this hurts a lot, Kat. I was just in Italy in October, and it's just, I met the most amazing people, and it's just shocking to think that 3,405 people have died already, just in Italy.
Yeah, Italy is a really, really tragic situation right now.
Wow. Well, Kat, I mean, again, it's such a, we walk a fine line because we want to bring people the most up-to-date and factual information we can without scaring anyone. And I just wonder what your thoughts are based on the scientists you've talked to, because the scientists and the doctors that we have interviewed say that once we get widespread testing, our numbers are going to shoot up. I mean, according to the Los Angeles Times, in LA County, which has a population of 10 million people, only 1,100 people have been tested by Tuesday. Here in the Bay Area, we've got about 7 million people. Do you know, Kat, how many people in the Bay Area have been tested so far?
That's a hard number to pin down, mostly because some counties do report how many people they've tested and some counties don't. So some counties will only say, this is how many positive people we've had, but they won't say this is how many total people we've tested. We know that statewide, at least as of last night, the governor said in California we had tested about 12,000 people.
We have seen drive-through testing happening in places like South Korea. I mean, we're going to talk about that in the second half of the show. They have just an incredible testing operation there. You report that Kaiser Permanente has drive-through testing at its San Francisco Medical Center on Geary Boulevard and other locations, but you have to be referred there by a doctor. Stanford Medicine has drive-through testing. You have to be referred by a physician. Patients are notified of results within 24 hours. UCSF is testing hospitalized patients, emergency department patients, and patients at its Parnassus San Francisco Respiratory Screening Clinic. But again, you should call your doctor first. Oh, and is it true that at UCSF a doctor's order is not required?
That's correct.
Okay. So,
but we should tell people that that doesn't mean that you can, you know, just walk in. You have to be quite sick, and okay, kind of go through an assessment with the doctor first.
So this raises a couple of questions. A basic one: what if you don't have a car? What if you are older and you're not mobile? What if you have a disability? How can you get tested at that point?
I think that's a great question. I think that might be something you have to work out with maybe someone who can give you a ride. You know, maybe a family member. You know, I know we also want to be careful right now about being in enclosed spaces. You know, if you're showing symptoms, you don't want to get someone else sick. You know, if you are sick and you need to get to a test, you don't have a car, I don't know, maybe you can put on a mask and see if someone can take you. You know, we are hearing some work being done around home testing. For example, phlebotomists, you know, may soon be able to go to your home and take a sample that way. That I think the details and the logistics are still being worked on, but they are working on that to solve this exact issue. You know, not everyone is able to leave their home.
Right. So, Kat, where is the best place people can go for information on this? I mean, you and your colleagues at the Chronicle have been doing excellent reporting on testing. Is there one place people can go for information on when more testing will become available?
You know, my reporting, I found a good source is a think tank, AEI, and they're actually tracking nationwide where testing capacity is, and as more labs are coming online, they're tracking that. That doesn't necessarily tell you, you know, for example, this is where you go to get a test, but it is tracking, you know, on a national level, this is how many tests we think are being done or will be done soon at each of these locations.
Did you say AEI?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the American Enterprise Institute?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. That is AEI.org. Well, Kat, thank you so much for all of your reporting. Thank you to the Chronicle for bringing down the paywall for COVID-19 stories, and we would love to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That is Catherine Ho. Kat covers healthcare and medical technology for the San Francisco Chronicle. You can find her pieces about testing at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will talk about a new Washington Post investigation called How Coronavirus Testing Stalled in the U.S., Flawed Tests, Red Tape, and Resistance to Using the Millions of Tests Produced by the WHO. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about testing. We do have the latest numbers from Johns Hopkins, and they are reporting that there are 10,775 cases in the United States, but without widespread testing, we just don't know the real numbers. It's really hard to know if there's a cluster in our area. We just don't know until we get more testing. So joining us now to talk more about this is Nina Satija. Nina has been an investigative reporter for the Washington Post since last January. Nina and her colleague Peter Wariski just wrote a very important piece about flawed tests, red tape, and resistance to using the millions of tests produced by the World Health Organization. Hi, Nina. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your important reporting. Hi, Nina. Are you with us?
I am, yes. Can you all hear me?
Great. Yes. Thank you so much, great. Nina. I just want to ask you a question that I asked Catherine Ho from the San Francisco Chronicle. She has been hearing from so many people who have symptoms and just the process of getting a doctor, figuring out if they should be tested, where they should go is very, very confusing. What has been your experience in hearing from citizens who have symptoms?
So I agree. I think that it has been very difficult for people to get guidance on whether they should get the test or not. But I also would like to reiterate, I think this is incredibly important right now. If you are having symptoms of this disease, you don't have a serious underlying health condition, and you think you can get better at home, please stay home. You will not get the test. You will not be able to get this test because other people are going to be ahead of you in the line who are more of a priority. That means that includes healthcare workers who can't stay home if they think they might have symptoms and they need a test. That includes first responders. It includes people who have to be out in the community every day to keep us safe. And I really worry that everyone out there is thinking they need this test if they have a tickle in their throat or they have a cough or they're sneezing. And that is not the case. You should not be seeking out a test unless you really feel like you need to be in the hospital because your symptoms are that bad, or you have a very serious underlying health condition. And so, unfortunately, we have heard from some of those folks who've had trouble getting the test as well, but I think that is the most important message I'd like to get out today looking forward to on this.
Yeah, and also, Nina, the other thing, we had a guest on last week who said, you know, it could be the flu, and so if you can, go to your doctor to find out if you have the flu, and if you don't, then you might want to take the next step. But what I'm thinking is if a bunch of people go to their doctors asking about flu symptoms, that's going to overwhelm hospitals as well.
I think you're right. And let's talk that through. Okay. So let's say I'm pretty sure that I've had the flu before. I've been lucky enough that I've been able to stay home and recover. And not everybody has that luxury. So I don't want to minimize that. The flu, it can be deadly. We've been talking about that a lot for the last few months. And so again, if you have an underlying health condition, if you're elderly, and you're experiencing these symptoms and you're really, really feeling like staying at home and trying to get better, you might put you in a really rough situation that you cannot handle. That is the time to call your doctor if you can. I know it's not easy for everyone to call their doctor. I can't call my doctor. I don't have a way to just dial my doctor's phone number. I have to get in touch with an office. I have to get him to call me back. You know, right. It's not easy. I get that. But I do feel that there are a lot of folks out there who are thinking, well, I want to go in and get a flu test. You know, and they may not need any test. They can get better at home. The priority is think about the people who we really need to know for sure that they don't have this virus, and that is healthcare workers, first responders, and other people who have to be out in the community for their jobs to keep everyone safe.
I also asked about people who are older and immobile, people with disabilities. I just got an email from Bill who said, what about people in wheelchairs? It's really difficult for people in wheelchairs to get a ride. And it just reminded me of an amazing disability rights activist we had on the show at the end of the year. And she couldn't even, and this was before the virus, this is like maybe in September. She said, I can't even get a ride from a hotel to your radio station because I'm in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm. I mean, again, that's all going to be very difficult. I think this crisis right now is certainly throwing into sharp relief, as we say. We like to use that in newspapers, that phrase, the inequities in our healthcare system when it comes to the most vulnerable. And I think that's important, and that's an important story. But that does not mean that everyone should get this test. And I think that is just, you know, I have been talking with lab directors. I've been talking with molecular diagnostician experts about what went wrong, and that was the story that Peter and I did. But I can't tell you how much they want to talk about what we need to understand going forward in terms of who needs this test and who should try to stay home if they absolutely can handle it.
Where are the tests? Can you talk about how they're rolling out? Because Governor Cuomo out of New York gave a press conference this morning and said 8,000 people were tested yesterday. So how is this being rolled out?
I think it really depends on the state. It depends on the county. It depends on your location. It depends on your doctor. So, you know, the first gatekeepers to this test, and I think that's most people would probably say that's quite appropriate, is the doctor. Now, and you have to get access to a doctor first, and that's a challenge for some people. I understand that. But the first thing is the doctor orders the test. The doctor decides if you need the test. Anyone getting these phone calls from companies saying, or, you know, things getting mailed to them, self-swab, do-it-yourself, not real, I mean, not valid, let's say, right. Not FDA-approved, not going to help you. You're not going to get any kind of meaningful result. It's a waste of your time and a waste of your resources. So, you know, that the first gatekeeper to the test is someone's doctor. But the thing to remember is there's another gatekeeper after that. The doctor orders the test. And, I mean, you know, every case is going to be different. I've heard from doctors who have tried to get the public health lab. Have tried to get the test through the public health lab. I think most people know now the public health labs were never meant to be the front line of coronavirus testing or any kind of infectious outbreak testing in the United States from a widespread. They don't have widespread testing capability, but some doctors are able to order it through the public health lab. Other doctors might have, you all might have heard of something called a LabCorp request account. Mm-hmm. So they already work with a larger kind of testing company. They're known as reference labs that they can then mail your swab to those companies. And wait to get the results. But that might take a few days because you've got to mail it. You know, the lab, the test isn't in your doctor's office. I've never seen a situation where someone, you know, can get a coronavirus test and they get the result in their doctor's office 2 hours later. That is not happening. The public health labs can sometimes get results more quickly. But again, it has to be sent to the lab. It has to be sent there. So that's something to be mindful of. When people talk about rapid diagnostic testing, yes, it's fast, but that doesn't mean that as soon as you go to your doctor and if they decide you need the test and they order it, you will get your result in 2 hours. That's, you know, there's a lot of things that have to happen in between. There's people that need to swab you. There's people that need to put that in a special bag, right, and wearing protective equipment themselves to protect themselves, and they need to bring that over to the lab or mail it in certain cases. So there's a second, you know, that's a second part of triage. And so what we hear from lab directors consistently is, We are getting more specimens than we have the ability to test. And so they are triaging again. And I've talked to lab directors who have told doctors, you know what, I think some of these patients, you know, they're not in the hospital, they're not healthcare workers, they're not first responders. And so instead of asking me to test this, I think you should send it to a reference lab. That might be LabCorp request, because this patient can afford to wait a few days because they're not even in the hospital to begin with. So that's another important thing to understand, is that there's a lot of triage going on right now.
Right. Well, today we are speaking with Nina Satija, an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. And Nina and her colleague Peter Woriski are out with a piece about why the testing has stalled. So let's dive into your piece, Nina. This is a really great piece. You kick off the piece writing about Olfert Lant, who is the founder of a small Berlin-based company, and he raced to help German researchers come up with a diagnostic test and then spurred his company to produce and ship more than 1.4 million tests by the end of February for the World Health Organization. He said that he and his wife were working 16-hour days, 7 days a week ever since. And then you write, by contrast, over the same critical period, U.S. efforts to distribute tests ground nearly to a halt. So put this in context for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is certainly what happened. I think we're starting to see, of course, more widespread testing capability in the U.S. since then. But absolutely, you know, the U.S. made a decision very early on, and it's one that the U.S., that presidential administrations have made during past outbreaks to, in some respects, to limit the availability of testing and limit who they were going to test. And folks may remember this from early February. You know, the decision was made that, you know, unless you're coming from China or a few other, you know, really specific criteria, you are not getting this test. You are not getting a coronavirus test. And at the same time, the decision was made, as has been in previous administrations during previous infectious disease outbreaks, the decision was made to for the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, to develop a test, diagnostic test. The CDC could do that test in-house. They scaled it up a little bit, and they sent out what are called test kits, about 200 of those, to public health labs across the country. So that's not your doctor's office. It's not a commercial lab testing. It's simply the public health laboratories in across the U.S. And the thinking from the CDC was, this is how we've always done it. We don't want a free-for-all testing environment where we have bad tests out there that, you know, are creating false negatives or false positives and creating unnecessary panic. I think also the administration, frankly, just didn't realize that that coronavirus may have already been spreading in the community. And so they felt like, we don't need a widespread test out there because this isn't that much of a threat. It's not widespread. And so they made those two decisions very early on to drastically limit the ability and the capacity of this country to do coronavirus testing. And then on top of that, very unfortunately, there was a flaw in the test that they did send out to those public health labs. And we're still trying to understand more about this flaw, you know, and I have to say the CDC has not been consistent with its explanations as to what went wrong. We've heard manufacturing issue. Then we heard it's definitely a manufacturing issue and not the actual test design itself. Now they're saying it could be the test design. There's still an investigation that's ongoing, and we're trying to figure that out. But the reality is the CDC decided to test very, very narrowly in the beginning, and then even that was almost impossible because the test didn't actually work for most of the public health labs that were trying to use it. So it was a really, really bad situation for a few weeks.
I mean, these numbers are so stark. From mid-January until February 28th, according to your reporting, fewer than 4,000 tests from the CDC were used out of more than 160,000 produced.
That's right, and that's only, you know, that's because only a handful of the public health labs were actually able to get the CDC test to work. And I've talked to some of those lab directors, you know. And so, you know, you had just a handful that managed to make the CDC test kits originally work for them and knew that they were getting valid results. You know, every lab, when they get a test kit to run a diagnostic test, they have to validate it. Before they even start testing patients, they're like, okay, let's run this against the negative sample and make sure we're getting the right results so something hasn't totally gone wrong here. Because if they don't validate and they start running it, and then they don't even know if there's a problem. And then you have a really big issue with possible false negatives and positives that you don't even know might exist. And so all these public health labs, they got the test kits from the CDC in early February, and they started to validate them. And the vast majority of them couldn't even validate the test. And for weeks afterward, that was the situation as the CDC was trying to work things out. And only by the end of February did that situation really get worked out. And I think the frustration among many experts and other labs that are not public health labs, you know, most of your run-of-the-mill hospital lab, your academic hospital labs, your clinical labs, they were saying, we think we know how to run this test. You know, let us run the test ourselves. And they were not given the authorization to do that by the government. And so we were stuck in this very bad situation.
So that was from mid-January until February 28th. What could have been done differently? What are you hearing from experts?
That's a really good question, and I think one of the things the CDC and the FDA and the Trump administration have continued to say is, look, we were following the protocol we always have followed. And I think, you know, talking to experts and those who worked in clinical labs who were sort of really wishing they could have used their test, and also public health labs that wanted a test that worked, you know, they think that it is probably time for a new approach, that someone needed to come in and say, look, we have almost no testing capability. And it's getting to be mid-February, the end of February. We can keep kind of imagining that means everything's fine because we're not getting any positives, right? But the reality is we don't even know. And so we need to bring in testing capability in some unconventional ways and maybe have the FDA authorize some other tests that normally would not have been authorized. But it would have been an unprecedented situation. It would have been a thinking outside of the box type of situation. Compared to what the CDC and, you know, administrations in these kinds of situations normally do. But that's certainly been a discussion. We've heard, you know, people from the NIH, for instance, talk about that in congressional hearings, that maybe we need to rethink our system.
It's also confusing because, you know, a couple of weeks ago, Donald Trump was basically saying anyone who needs a test can get a test. And I've been watching all of their press conferences, and, you know, over the last 2 weeks, the messaging has been very confusing, even on the Sunday shows.
I agree the messaging has been incredibly confusing. I think that people have been, unfortunately given the impression, again, that they should be going out and getting this test and that they could get one if they need one. And the reality is that is not the case. And I don't think it will be the case for some weeks. And frankly, I don't think it should. I mean, certainly people who doctors decide, really decide should need the test, they should be able to get the test. But, you know, simply anyone who thinks they need a test can get the test. That's really not how this works. And I don't think that's good messaging. And so, you know, again, I think some of the misunderstandings from those statements were, you know, just even when this issue was resolved with the FDA and other clinical labs were able to run their own tests, and even when the CDC, you know, finally claimed that it had fixed its problem with its own tests and sent out new test kits, again, you know, once you send out those test kits, someone has to run those tests. Nothing is automatic. And I've made this analogy before. I've heard many lab directors make it where, you know, I would say, imagine that I said I was going to be able to make 1 million cakes, and I had a press conference in front of America and told them that. And I had, even if I had all the ingredients I wanted, I mean, you know, you've got one person and they've got to mix everything. They've got to have the ingredients right. They have to have the oven working. You know, these things do not happen instantaneously. Anyone who does any kind of, you know, any kind of job, whether it's scientific or not, should understand that. So I think every time we hear these promises about new testing capability and how many tests are going to be done, you know, what lab directors are thinking and telling me, they're saying, I don't know how we're going to do that. You know, we don't have enough genetic extraction kits. We don't have enough swabs. I've been hearing from doctors who say we don't have enough collection tubes to put the sample in. And so that's why, you know, unfortunately, the messaging coming out of the administration at times saying that, you know, everyone who needs a test can get a test, you know, is just not the case.
Right. In fact, in your piece, you spoke with Dr. James Lawler, director of the Global Center for Health Security at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He was on our show yesterday, and he said it's very nuanced and complicated to make a diagnostic test. And I think this is really important because, again, many of us who've had a blood test or other tests, in many cases, some tests are very, very simple. But I think a lot of people are now learning that this test has many parts to it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, no test is perfect. And that's why, you know, again, when the president talked about self-swabbing yesterday and how that was the new approach, we treated that as did many lab directors who I called and asked what they thought about it and diagnosticians, you know, with some skepticism saying, you know, self-swab. I mean, let's think that through for a minute. You've got to stick a swab up your nose all the way up in a very, very uncomfortable way and twist it around. So the concern is a lot of people are not going to do that correctly. They're not going to do that in a way that's safe, or they're just going to, and they're going to do it in a way that, and then send it out to a lab and then expect a result that is not gettable because they didn't do the swab correctly, you know. And so same with drive-through testing clinics. I spoke to the public health lab director in Nebraska yesterday, and he said, you know what, I'm really afraid of drive-through testing clinics in our state because that will just cause everyone to rush and think that they need the test because it's easy for them to get it. And then they're going to be waiting days and days, if not longer, for the results because we don't have the capacity to do more tests. So that's really another thing to remember is think carefully about whether you need this test. I'm not minimizing the fact that some people who really may need the test, whose doctors think they need it, are still not able to get it or they're not able to get in touch with a doctor. But I do think there is a large chunk of people out there, because we're hearing this from doctors and lab directors, who really don't need this test and they're getting it ordered, you know, but they have symptoms, they're able to stay at home, but they're coming in. They're going somewhere to get the test, and they're overwhelming the system in some cases.
Right. ABC News had a video showing very long lines of people in their cars at testing sites. Another question for you. There have been some stories about this, and a reporter asked the Trump administration yesterday about the NBA players and actors and basically people with money who seem to have access to these tests, whereas an editor at the New York Times, Tim Herrera, shared on Twitter yesterday that he tested positive for COVID-19. He said, it took me a dozen calls with 5 healthcare providers, 2 hours of hold music, 2 hours in a hospital, and 4 days of waiting to find out. So do you have any insights about some of these discrepancies that we're seeing? Why do basketball players and actors seem to have faster access to these testing kits, Nina?
You know, I don't. I guess I would take issue with whether they really have faster access or not. I think that that data, while important to look at, is very, very anecdotal. And, you know, I think that the public health lab directors in those cases, like for the Utah Jazz team, have said, look, we had a known positive already. We had someone that had symptoms, I believe. And, you know, we knew immediately there were 57 people who had come into close contact with that person. You know, how could we not test? Now, my colleagues, my colleague Juliet Alperin someone on our sports team had a great story this morning that dug into this, and they actually found that there had been a paramedic in Oklahoma at the same time who was really quite sick and needed the test and wasn't able to get it. Meanwhile, the Utah Jazz team was getting tested. So that is one example, I think, of potentially jumping the line that has caused a lot of concern. But from an aggregate standpoint, I'm just going to come out and say I don't think we really know for sure who is getting access to this test and who isn't and why. Again, doctors have to order this test. I think it is, again, showing the inequities in our health system. People who can get access to a doctor quickly are more likely to, you know, then be able to get the test because the doctor has to order it. And the private doctors, the so-called concierge doctors we've been hearing about, they are more likely to have a LabCorp request account, or they're more likely to maybe have access to the public health lab potentially, you know, to do these tests. But again, even they may be getting turned away sometimes. You know, many of us have spoken to Alex Greninger, lab director at University of Washington, and I asked him about this. And he, you know, I asked him last week, I said, okay, you guys can test 1,800 people a day. Are you getting more demand? He said, yes. You know, he said, we actually got 2,300 specimens yesterday. And so what they've decided, again, they've triaged. And I don't think they're triaging based on anyone's income. They are triaging based on people who are in the hospital already, people who are healthcare workers and first responders. That's who they're testing first. So I, you know, again, I think it is important to look at inequity in testing, but I also don't want people to read into that and think that means they need this test when they don't. And, you know, I pulled up the New York Times article from Tim Herrera, which I thought was really great. But I also would like to note that he himself, you know, says in the story, why we were given the test is still a mystery. Him and his roommate were two young, active people, only one of whom had symptoms and none of which were severe. Hmm. You know, he says that in the story. And of course, his doctor ordered the test, and I certainly am glad he was able to get it. But I think he acknowledged himself in the article that maybe it was not necessary. And I think that's important for people to remember.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this and for getting the word out.
Nina Satija is an investigative reporter with The Washington Post, and you can find the piece she wrote about testing and what is happening at the CDC at yourcallradio.org. And we will continue focusing on testing and bringing you the information that you need on it. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.